any burning questions from last night? How many people besides you two? Were you there last night? I knew it. Welcome. That's hard for me to use. So that's as good as it's going to get. There's my good friend, Dr. Cliff Hall. All right, well, that's us.
Hi, Cliff.
Is there anyone else who wasn't at the session last night? Okay, for those of you that I haven't met or been introduced to before, my name is Don Coverly. My professional title is Senior Hydrogeologist. I work for URS Corporation, which is an engineering consulting firm that has been retained by Rio Tinto, the mining company that is doing the work across the creek on the mine site. I came here for the first time in 1997 and have been coming back off and on regularly ever since, and have been fortunate enough to be on volunteer teaching staff on multiple occasions and teaching for the Calgary Village for 6 or 7 years. So last night we started doing some more. Here's the schedule for today. One is the introduction. Two, we're going to talk about pipe tomorrow, a little bit of preparation for that. Three, we're going to talk a little bit more about lake tectonics, both recap and expand on what we talked about last night because we did that pretty quickly. And then four, we're going to talk about the whole mine history from 1896 to 1938 being the first time that concentrate was shipped from here down lake. So, first things. What I want to talk to you about is, this came to me a little while ago, why should you, Karen, study geology? Why should you be here? One, geology is puzzle solving. I spoke about that last night. Brain researchers agree about mental capacity. Use it or lose it. Is that true, Dr. Pesce?
No, that's true.
Dr. Nancy? Unsolicited and unpaid opinions. And what I understand about it, I didn't just make this up. There's some truth to that, as we have proof. But what I understand is also important is that as we age, we try to engage in new and different activities. And you say, well, I do the crossword puzzle. I've been doing it every day for the last 60 years. Not you guys, 60 years, of course not. But okay, 35 years. I'm going to just keep doing it. Well, you got to add some new stuff. And one thing about geology is nobody has ever figured out all of geology. I'm up here, and I've been working up here for 12 years, and when I was here 2 weeks ago, I found out something new that's in my area of specialty that I probably should have known about a decade ago, but never late than ever. So, the puzzles are always changing in geology. Two, geology is done outside, takes a while, and is done at a slow pace. We can talk about geology here, and we can, the same way that we could play miniature golf, but if you want to play golf, you've got to go out in the world to do it. So, gentle aerobic exercise or long walks outside, best exercise ever? Doctors? Pretty close, right? Okay. It's done outside because that's where the rocks are. It takes a while because I run sometimes. You can't do geology when you're running. It's going by. You can't do it when you're driving. Not very well. And it's done at a slow pace. You got to stop and you got to think and you got to look. Three, sooner or later, geology is done in community. Intellectual pursuit done with others equals a good thing. That's true. I can study the geology of this area, and historically that's what people do, but sooner or later you have to throw a map down on a table in front of other people who are trained in that profession and say, this is the geology, and let's go out and look at the rocks together. And there are stories in the geologic lore of me mapping one direction and Cliff coming the other way and getting to a point and our maps not matching, then it's rock hammers at 20 paces. Or we have to do, so sooner or later, everything that I've done on the My Project for the last 12 years, I'm the one that comes up with the first idea or the first hypothesis, but then I have to compare this with other people who are, some of whom are smarter than me, some of whom are less experienced than me, some of whom have different opinions than I do. And we come to some consensus about the way the world works. So that communal aspect, I think the doctors would tell us that people who either live or interact in community live longer than those people who are isolated. Am I right about that?
That's true, and we'll report on that on Wednesday as well.
We'll report on that on Wednesday. Number four, geologists drink beer. That's not just it's not just mythology, that's actually true. And what will the doctors tell us? Moderate alcohol use proven to add years to life. This is not a beer commercial. That's reality, right? Two drinks a day, is that what the
reality?
That's non two drink a day drinkers live longer than non-drinkers. So number five, geologists get paid to bash rocks with a hammer. Stress reduction plus weight training equals success. So, why should you study geology? There's a whole bunch of reasons why I think you should do it. There are some of the, I think what I'm doing by promoting geology is promoting a version of exercise. What the doctors will tell you is you have to exercise. It will add years to your life. It will make you better. Everything about it. Whether you ride a bike or run or walk or swim, those are all different varieties of exercise. If you can find something else where you get to do all these things, solve puzzles, do it outside, do it at a slow pace, do it in community, get to drink beer, to smash stuff with a hammer, then do that instead. Why should you study bird watching? Some of this applies, but some of it doesn't. And there may be some things, right? Bird watching is puzzle solving. You got to know where to look for the birds. Geology, it's done outside. It takes a while there. You're sitting probably for a while waiting for the bird to come by. It's probably not in community. Right? You could probably drink while you. I don't know. The bashing stuff with rock hammers probably doesn't fit there, but there may be something else. I happen to think that geology is a good sport to be involved in. And there are a number of reasons why you should do that. Okay, that's number one, which leads me into number two, the hike preparation. So I was thinking about this morning. One of the reasons that I snarled at Jim Bodine, the poet, yesterday in my writing about not being the boss of me and telling me to try to do two things at once. I do some work in Ghana working with a group over there, and one of the things I'm sent there to do is train them. And if you would drop into the lab there in central Ghana and walk in the back door and yell in the back door, "What's Don's number one rule?" Five different guys would turn around and say, "One thing at a time." Because that's my number one rule, because that's all I can do, one thing at a time. So when Jim Bodine says, "Keep writing your letter, not listening to me," you're trying to listen to him and write at the same time. That's impossible for me. But today I broke that rule because I was doing two things at once. I was brushing my teeth and I was thinking about the novel's hype. And what came to me was my thrust of tomorrow's hike will be this: geology is puzzle solving. That's the tack I'm going to take tomorrow. What hit me, the epiphany I had while I was brushing my teeth, was that might not be why you would be coming. Pat, who's not here right now, might come to the hike tomorrow because she thinks I'm going to give out the licorice. Cliff is going to come because Ye wants to come, and Cliff's married to Ye, and But if Lisa doesn't come, then he might get in trouble later. So that has nothing to do with geologic puzzle solving. Cliff is also going to try to throw roadblocks in my way as I'm talking tomorrow. Because no matter what you think about him, deep inside he's a genius man. My housemate down in Portland, where I rent the room, if she were coming on the geology hike, she would be looking for rocks that she could put in her pocket and take home that have interesting patterns. So she wouldn't care at all. The fact that I'm talking about puzzle solving would be like Charlie Brown's teacher, right? Wah, 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 wah. And she would have a great hike. Marianne Junghans, who some of you may know through the Holden Village community, would be out with her camera because she wants to take pictures that because of when we go and what the conditions are, she will get a picture that she's never seen before in her life. This is the part I'm going to talk about, the puzzle-solving aspect of geology. And any of you that come along, another thing that I will try to do is to convince you that you too can be a geologist. Because my belief is geology is about 98% common sense. And you've all shown some degree of common sense by being able to get here. You can function an automobile. Directions on the map, or you listen when you can. You already have the capacity to be a geologist. What I'm going to do, and what I try to do in these other sessions, is take things that you know, compare those things to things in the geologic world so that then you can apply them, and then you can be a geologist so that you can do all of these things so that you can live longer, be happier, drink more beer, and smash more stuff with a geologist. If you are coming to the hike tomorrow and have some other specific thrust that you would like to talk about, what I'm going to talk about is, Yay this morning, Cliff this morning at breakfast was complimenting me on the talk I gave last night and was looking to Yay for backup on that. And she said, yeah, that was a really great talk Don gave about geology because he didn't talk about the rocks. Well, so now I'm going to try to strive to talk, do more geology sessions than have nothing to do with rocks. Tomorrow, what I plan to talk about is going back to this idea of time and treasure and talking about how we as geologists decide which rocks are old and which rocks are young, and how old is old and how young is young, and when we can tell simply a comparative age between younger and older, and when we can tell a definite age. And I will start tomorrow with an analogy for that that we may go off into since then. If you're planning on coming to the hike tomorrow and would like some other thrust or some need to talk about something else you can think about that and see me later or talk to me about it tomorrow before the hike starts. Probably just do it then because then it'll be fresh in my mind and I will have had less time to make up something completely falling and it will probably be real. The hike is at 10:30. We will meet up on the park. My good friend Cliff Hall will go to the hike house and get a bunch of walking sticks. The hike is a little over a mile, might be a mile and a half, but it's on the 10-mile Falls Trail, which is wheelchair accessible. There's a fairly steep but short hill at the start, and then it's pretty flat all the way out to the end. There is a seating area 80% of the way to the end, which is where we will terminate the geology portion of the talk, but if we continue out, we can go to see waterfalls and sit on the nice wooden. Are there benches out there or are there just the platform? Okay. And if it gets to be that time and some people are hanging out there, if they will talk to me and let me know they're going to stay for a while and the time gets late, food is available in the dining hall until 1:15 at least. So there is, unless you're going to take a whole long time, you won't need to pack a lunch. You can come All right, any questions? Any?
You guys beer in your...
Sorry?
You didn't mention beer.
It's in his beer bottle there.
If this was beer, it's hard liquor. All right. So yesterday, in the middle part of the talk, we talked about the idea for the plate tectonic theory, which I said is a relatively new and comprehensive theory of geology. And what I didn't talk about at all at that point is, one, what's a theory? Two, why do we think we need one? And so as I was sitting at my desk, I decided to write down my first shot effort at what a theory is. I didn't go over to upstairs there and get on the Google and find out what the bloody definition was, because we're like, what is a theory? I said a set of principles that connect phenomena in a coherent manner. Anybody got a better definition on the tip of their tongue? Alright, we'll go with what I said. Okay, so what are the geologic phenomena that occur to people? There's volcanoes out there. Why do we find volcanoes where we find them? Why do we have earthquakes where we have earthquakes? Why do we find certain rock formations where we find certain rock formations? And converse to that, that might be equally important, is why are there places where there aren't earthquakes? Right? Anybody here from Nebraska? Nebraska's not big earthquakes. That enough to know that the middle part of the country there aren't here. Why are there earthquakes in some places? Why are there not earthquakes?
The biggest one of the World War 48 was right in exploring Missouri.
You're absolutely right. The New Madrid quake in 1811?
It was 1800 something.
And do you remember that by
chance? I think it was 18. You probably right.
When I started studying geology back in 1977, as I spoke about last night, there were a number of these geologic phenomena that the distribution of them, we had a term. It was called not well understood. The fact that there would be this common phrase, is there something in
Idiopathic.
So that if you're doing a technical paper,
which means the cause is unknown,
and you get to a certain point where you go, I don't know. Well, it's idiopathic. Well, I'm never going to go back to not well understood. So we now have this theory called plate tectonic theory that does that thing, which is connect these geological phenomena in a coherent way. And I had the big lava lamp out to show that it is hot. What are the basics of plate tectonics theory? The people who weren't there last night, you're excused for the moment because you don't even know this. But the people who were there last night. That's two of them. What's the driving mechanism? That's three. And then the fourth, which is a little bit less well, is the rate at which things happen. There are four basic tenets to plate tectonics theory. The surface of the Earth, what we think of as being stuff that's immovable, is really about 20 to 25 brittle plates. They float around and move around on material which is viscous but ductile. It's stout but it flows. driving mechanism for that is convection. The Earth is solid and extremely hot in the middle. That's the core. This is the, like, the Tootsie Roll part. And heat is dissipated from the hot part in the middle to the cold part at the ends. And the lava lamp showed these big blobs of material that were heated by a light bulb in the middle, and they would rise up and then cool and then fall back down. What happens in the world as we think, or the planet as we know it, is there are these convection currents or convection cells that form, and it's this motion of the fluid material that causes the brittle plates on the surface, which an analogy is those are about the thickness of an apple skin to an apple. Okay. Anybody with me on that? What we think of as being the brittle plates. The plates are made up of two types of crust, thin and crispy, and thin and chewy. Well, that's pizza. Oceanic crust and continental crust. And best I recollect is this is usually about 6 miles thick, and this is something like 20 to 30 miles thick. And the source of oceanic crust is when these convection cells occur, what happens is they will pull apart the crust. This is in the, if you're familiar with the mid-ocean ridge that separates U.S. and South America from Europe and Africa, there is a ridge there where the force is outwards in the two directions, pushing North America, South America, westerly, Europe, Africa, easterly. A break forms in the crust, new material bubbles up and creates new crust as the plates are tugged in two directions. Now, if that were the only manifestation of plate tectonics and these convection cells, then the planet should get bigger. That isn't what happened. So what happens? You have to have this oceanic crust taking up some of the place, and that is in a place that we call the subduction zone, or that we call a subduction zone. One of the data points, one of the data points that got us to the point that we believe plate tectonics theory is this oceanic crust that we find underlying the oceans. The oldest oceanic crust anywhere on the planet is about 250 million years old. If we go back to our 24-hour clock from yesterday, 250 million years ago is about 10:30 at night in our 24-hour clock. Used an analogy yesterday to say the history of the Earth. I believe the Earth is 4.56 billion years old. We turn that into a 24-hour clock when the various events happen. So this oceanic crust, oceans cover 70% of the planet. So oceanic crust underlies 70% of the planet. And the oldest stuff we can find is 250 million years old. What's the oldest rocks on the continents that we found? 3 billion 4 billion years old. Here's this one type that covers a great part of the planet. And we can't find it being old anymore. And another bit of information that came out, as you are at the mid-ocean ridge in the Atlantic, and you look on a mile each way from the mid-ocean ridge, that material is very young, 10,000 years old. You go out another mile, and now it's 30,000 years old on both sides. You go out another mile, got another mile, and it's 100,000. And as you go from these ridges towards the edges of the continents, it gets older, and it gets the same older on both sides of the ridge. Now, when those data first started to come back in the early 1960s, that was the start of what we think of as the tectonic revolution. And we did not have the technology until around that time to be able to core and then age date, and then also another bit that goes into the puzzle is that those rocks have a different magnetic signature. And on both sides of the ridge, the signatures would match up precisely as you would move away from the ridge. So what happens is new crust is being generated all the time. You said the rate of generation the rate of movement of tectonic plates is about the same rate at which your fingernail grows. So inconceivably slow on a day-to-day basis. But then I made the story that if you have 100 or if you have 1 million years to grow a fingernail, you can grow a long fingernail. What happens in places where the oceanic crust, why isn't the planet getting bigger? Is that when oceanic crust, like is happening on the west coast of South America right now, or has happened on the west coast of the US in geologic time, here's the west coast of the US, and this is continental crust, so this is 20 to 30 miles thick. This is 6 miles thick. Here's the water. When these things bump into one another, this has a tendency to act as a snowplow and plow right over the top of the oceanic crust, which is driven below. What do we know about the center of the Earth? It's hotter. This gets driven down. It begins to melt. I have color here. And melts differentially. It doesn't all melt at the same time or in the same, you don't melt it totally in the moment. So that material has it fractionates. A portion of it comes off and a portion of it stays with the plate. And the material that is driven off is now molten and hot and begins to intrude into the continental crust and makes big batholiths. Batholith is a big pod or pool of molten rock that rises up and cools slowly as it comes to the surface. Yosemite National Park, the big granites that we find down there are representative of batholiths. They cool at some depth. One thing that happens as this plate is being subducted and this is steamrolling and the front end sort of acts as a cow catcher, the whole front edge of the plate will start to be tipped up because we're trying to jam a bunch of stuff in there. Ground level will rise, mountains will rise, they'll be eroded down, and sooner or later, after lots of generations, this will be the new surface of the planet, or the new surface of the will be exposed to the surface. And we're not going to see that until tomorrow. We will see some of these grand batholiths as we go up and down and out. 10 mile per trail.
So,
please go ahead.
Actually drilled through 30 miles?
Actually drilled? No. We believe this continental crust is 20 to 30 miles thick by using geophysical techniques, seeing how earthquake waves motivate differently from different materials. If you take a tuning fork and put it in the water and listen to it underwater, you would get something. If you put it in a pool of oil, you would get a different tone. By knowing what the differences in those tones are, the frequencies, now make a guess as to what density of the material is. Another thing is this continental crust is generally less dense than the oceanic crust. One of the things, what happens as it gets deeper? toddle. You get to a point where the plate is no longer brittle. You're trying to push a piece of jello into another thing that's a little bit flowy, and you get earthquakes. No, you don't get earthquakes. So there is some limit as you go away from the coast, and I don't know why I forget what that distance is, beyond which if you get away from one of these subduction zones where the plate's diving underneath, you no longer get earthquakes. You no longer get earthquakes because the plate's no longer brittle. The theory explains another set of phenomena. It explains why we get, what happens with this fractionation. The first manifestation of this fractionation is we get volcanoes. So that what right now, if you look along the west coast of South America, there are a bunch of volcanoes. If you look historically along the west coast of the U.S., there are a bunch of volcanoes called the Cascades. There's one called Mount St. Helens that erupted not so very long ago. This is where we are in South America right now. This is where we were in North America not too long ago and still ongoing. If you go down to California, this phase happened a long time ago. Those volcanoes are all eroded away, and now the continent is really down here in the Atlantic.
Is the crust different?
Something viscous so that it's no longer brittle. And the plates and plates and crust are not coincident in all cases. So that some plates are made up of both continental and oceanic crust. Okay? Some plates are made up. I want to go through this. We've talked about, let me hold on to that for a second, and if I have an answer in a few more minutes, then tell me again. If you have two kinds of crust, thin and crispy and thick and chewy, you have oceanic crust and continental crust, there are how many different ways that they can interact with one another? You can have, in this case, we have oceanic crust being subducted underneath continental crust, right? We have the possibility that we could have oceanic crust being subducted under oceanic crust. This is what's happening in Indonesia right now. We have continental crust. Continental crust is never subducted under oceanic crust. It's always overrising. But we have continental crust that could butt up, could run into continental crust, right? That possibility exists. And that's, in fact, what's happening in the Himalayan mountains right now. There is a continental plate, or a plate with continental crust on it, that India sits on, that sometime fairly recently, I don't know the precise date, let's say 50 million years ago, sucker punched Eurasia from below. Now, when you have continental crust running into continental crust, that's two trucks running into each other. You got two 20 to 30s bashing into each other. And what happens?
Somebody goes up.
In this case, what's happening is a bloody head-on collision between two trucks. Is both are being, like, this is time one, time two is like this, where they haven't figured out between the two plates which one's going to win, so they've just mashed, they punched right into each other, and what happens in the middle is the continental high spot here, and I forget which side of the suture it's on, this thing would be called a suture. Right. We get what we call a mountain. It's no surprise that the tallest mountains anywhere on the planet are in a place where we have two things running into each other, which are already about the tallest things on the planet. So that's, we got oceanic, that's Indonesia. We got oceanic continental, that's South America right now, North America historically. We have continental, that's the Himalayas. What's left? Continental, oceanic, that doesn't happen. Now, if we talk about all we've talked about so far, no, that's not true. In the first picture I drew for you, we had oceanic crust going away from each other, right? We have the situation, we have one situation on the planet where continental crust is being pulled apart. This is the East African Rim. So that the plate, this is where the plates crust are not coincident, so that there is continental crust on two blades. Or there was a plate called the Africa, or whatever it's called, that Africa happens to be sitting on and was minding its own business and has been for some geological time. And just like if you plug in a lava lamp, those convection cells are somewhat random. Sometimes the blob goes up the one side of the bowl, and sometimes it goes right up the middle, and sometimes it's big, and sometimes it's small. For some reason, there has been a change in the convection cell that used to go somewhere, so that the spreading center was here. And now, for some reason, that's decided to go another way. Now the spreading center is here. The continental crust happens to be sitting on top of it. And so what is happening today in Africa is this crust is being pulled apart. We call that the East African Rift. So that in another 50 million years, the corner of Africa okay, if that's Africa. that rift at least runs like this, so that in sometime not far in the geological future, there will be a Red Sea-ish. This, and that's where this runs back. This runs through the Red Sea, so that area is being pulled apart as well. So at some point in the future, there will be a minor, a shallow sea running through the entirety of Africa. One of the things that I said that we used as a geologic phenomenon that helps to be explained by plate tectonics is the distribution of rocks. Alfred Wegener, who came up with the idea of continental drift back in 1912 or 1916, one of the things that he noticed was, next time you're playing around with your atlas, make a copy of it and cut out Africa and South America and then put it together. And South America fits it right here. And one of the things that geologists had known for some time is here are these rocks in South Central Africa that go to the edge of the sea and then stop, and then other geologists halfway across the world continent happen to find very similar rocks, and if you match up the two continents, you find the same rock. Now, that was one of the really compelling pieces of information that Wegener used to say, give me another explanation of how something like this could happen. The reason that he got chased and laughed out of the scientific meetings in those days was no one could conceive of convection cells, or the idea that the mantle, the stuff underlying the brittle plates, was somehow ductile and float. He had some other Herbert schemes too, but no one could So what was lunacy in 1916 is now, I don't want to say orthodoxy, but is now the commonly accepted unifying theory of the science of geology. So that ties back into the last thing we talked about last night with how the Holden line got here, which is, how did the Holden line get here? Did we talk about this today?
No.
Somewhere in the geologic past, there was an island arc similar to what we see today. Volcanoes exploding. Those volcanic eruptions are very dramatic. Another thing that plate tectonics explains, I won't go into it right now, Hawaiian volcanoes are dramatically different from Mount St. Helens volcanoes, right? Hawaiian volcanoes, the lava is very flowy, not very viscous. The cones get built up at a low angle. The eruptions are not very dramatic. Right? As long as you don't happen to be right next to the vent when it goes, you can run away. Compare that to Mount St. Helens type volcanoes, which are very much stiffer, very much more angular when the explosions happen, like Mount St. Helens or Mount Krakatoa back in 1963 or whenever it was. Those are huge, unfriendly explosions, right? Kills people for miles around, generates tidal waves. The energy that's involved is very much greater. That can be explained by plate tectonics, and I'll be glad to talk about that over a cup of tea. But we think that 250-ish million years ago, there was an island arc, something like Indonesia is today. Volcanoes erupting, heat source down below, what we call black smoker vents, because the water is superheated, it can pick up more gold, copper, silver, and zinc than normal water can. What was the word we used? What was the good word we used last? Spewed out into low, shallow seas with this superheated water, comes in contact with cold, oxygenated water, and flocks out, crystallizes out, we'll use that for the moment, into muds, because the volcanoes, as they get built, what happens when something gets built up in the environment? It gets worn back down. Volcanoes get built up by explosive forces, get eroded by erosive forces. The mud goes off into the shallow seas, gets mixed with the ore materials into shallow muds. That island arc then over time gets smashed onto the west coast of the United States, 100 million years ago, smashed onto the west coast of the North American continent in sort of chain of islands, which over between 100 million years ago and 20 million years ago added material. 100 million years ago, the west coast of North America was somewhere around the Idaho-Montana border, and the history of the building of the continent since then has been mashing on bits of island arcs, islands the size of Indonesia or Japan, or not as big as Australia. So there was a piece that came in east of where we are now. Sometime 20, 30 million years later, the piece that we're standing on now came in. Sometime after that, the piece that's now going to Princeton. And now we have to stay as we see it. All right. That's plate tectonics recap and expansion, unless there are questions. Any questions? Okay, let's change gears. For the last 15 minutes, we'll talk about the Holden Line site history from 1896 to 1938. Father James Henry Holden. That's not true. was born in 1855 in Springfield, Massachusetts. What else happened in Springfield, Massachusetts?
Birthplace of basketball.
Springfield, Massachusetts, the birthplace of basketball, the place where Dr. Naismith mailed up the peach baskets, and now we got. Holden was born in 1855 in Springfield, was raised in New York State, moved west to Nevada when he was 19, worked in the mines in Nevada for a while, worked hard but didn't make any money, moved to Denver, worked at a smelting operation there as an ore assayer, worked that job for a while, and then the job was terminated and he moved to Seattle in 1888. When he was in Seattle, he met Victor Denny. Apparently the Dennys were mucky mucks in the northwestern Washington area. This was the son of the Scion family. Is that the right word? Okay. And Denny and Holden were the same age and became friends. And from 1888 till about 1893, Holden worked various odd jobs on the Olympic Peninsula. Holden moved to the Olympic Peninsula, settling first in Port Angeles and then in Dungeness. He prospected in the Olympics and on several occasions wrote Victor saying he had served as a judge and a coroner. Victor Denny replied to Holden's assertions by chiding him that he probably was judge of sauerkraut and a coroner of beefsteak. In the early 1890s, the Dennys did have mine holdings and also did were mine operators. So in the early 1890s, Holden came to the Lake Chelan area as what he would say was a representative of the Denny family. The person that I've talked to most about this is a fellow who's here in the summer. If you come back in the summer and you want to come hear this talk given by a guy named Rick Dunning, he's the curator of the Mine Museum, and he knows more about Holden history. Then there are two people I would go to and Rick is the one that you would have more access to. And his, as we talked about Holden a couple of weeks ago, he said as he studied Holden, he when he was feeling good, he thought Holden was a snake. And when he was feeling bad, he thought Holden was a slime ball. So Holden, as we'll come to learn, Holden was always good at promotion and always good at looking out for his own individual interests, even when other people who thought they were working with him thought they were working with him collaboratively. So, Holden came here 3 or 4 years in a row, 1890, 3, 4, and 5, and at various times members of the Denny family would come out with him and they would prospect. Mostly now along the Lake Chelan shoreline. 1896 was the first year that there was prospecting done in the Railroad Creek Valley. And the Holden and Denny spent the early part of that summer prospecting down at the bottom, down by the lake. Denny had to leave. He sold his remaining supplies to Holden. Holden contracted with a guy to bring stuff for him up the valley, which was done. Robertson was his name. And then in July of 1896, Holden was out shooting a quail for lunch and saw the Red Rock, which is up on the flank of Copper Peak here. And quit hunting for lunch and started looking at rocks and decided that he had made more discovery. patented four claims. Robertson felt that he was due some consideration for the work that he had done. And getting Holden up here, and so Holden immediately passed along to him the one claim of the four that he felt was worthless. That turned into some bad blood between Robertson and Holden later on. And through 1890, Holden did some assaying in 1896, both early in the season and late in the season. And late in the season, he collected two sets of samples to send to Seattle. He sent the first set on to the assayer that he knew that the Dennys knew about, and that those samples would be reported back to the Dennys. And he set a second set of samples to be assayed on the Dell Hub. Only to be reported back to him. Now, Seattle at the time, 1896, was fairly small, and that scheme was illuminated and passed along to the Dennys. And the Dennys, particularly Victor, were very sort of unanimous about the whole deal. But by 1897, it was clear that Holden's intent was to cut the Dennys out of everything, that he registered the claims in his name only, despite the fact that in those 1893, 4, 5 years, that the Dennys had provided Holden with money and some support. So, in 1899, Holden incorporated the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. We'll have a picture of one of the issue of one of the certificates of stock. This is Holden in the early mining days on the left. I believe that's in the valley or in the creek because I think there's an outline of one of these behind it. Here's Holden somewhat later on. Back in the good old days when they let you have dogs. Sorry, guys. I'm not looking to cause trouble. I think it's probably a good thing at all. This is the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company was capitalized for $250,000. The thing I think I see here that's interesting is these were signed on Christmas Day. Is that what that reads to everybody? Mm-hmm. $12.25.99. The history, since I'm gonna have to summarize this fairly quickly. Next 5 minutes. Holden did two things, sort of not simultaneously, but on a yearly basis, sort of simultaneously. When it was summer and the weather was good, he was up here trying to figure out how big the mine was, how big the ore reserve was, trying to develop the mine, trying to develop the infrastructure of the mine itself, trying to get ore samples. When the weather got bad, he'd go back down the hill and try to promote the mine to find buyers. Holden, I don't think, ever saw himself as someday being a big mine owner. What he saw himself as was being a mine developer who sold a mine to somebody else and then retired as a gentleman, ex-mine owner. So he was always into it for the buyout, for the payout. I have over here sort of a timeline of different organizations who owned the mine or had leases to purchase the mine. So from 01 to 03, there was a thing called the Drummer Development Company. They came up, they spent some time, they did these things, the same things that he was doing, trying to develop the mine here and trying to promote the mine downhill. They ran out of money and patience in 03. Holden reacquired from 03 to 05, from 1905 to 1915, there was an outfit that came in that was called Grandy. They were out of Canada. 1905 to 1910 or 11, there was a lot of effort that went in here. 11 to 15, Grandy sort of fell back, they, being a Canadian company, decided they were going to focus on their other work. In the last days, sort of 12, 13, 14, Holden had always been on the board of directors of the Holden Gold Copper Mining Company, but in those last few years, he was not part of the board. Randy quit. He came back in 1915 and 1918. Holden died in 1918. Died of cancer. In 1917, Holden had taken out a loan from a guy who wound up owning the mine, local Chelan apple grower by the name of Crooker Perry. Buy a mine from Ben Crooker. From 1918 to 1922, it was held both by Perry, as I have written in my notes. Crooker Perry gets involved in mine to protect his assets. Anyway, from 1918 to 1922, Perry and Mrs. Holden, Holden, when he got married about 1900, he was 43 and his wife was 20. So she was still alive and well. There was a lawsuit between Perry and the Holden estate so that he got total ownership in 1922. Then he did what Holden had been doing, what BDC had been doing and what Granby had been doing, which is working up here during the winters trying to make the mine a bigger, better thing, and then going out for the winter and trying to get something to buy. Finally, in 1925, Perry dissolved the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company and revamped the Lake Chelan Copper Company, came out of the ashes, which in 1930 he sold to Britannia Mining, which then changed its name to Howe Sound, which is how Howe Sound owned the Holden mine. This picture was taken of Holden in about 1913 when he was sort of on the outs with Granby and hadn't yet resumed ownership. This is the Holden house down in Chelan. Exterior and interior. Holden had four sons.
Is it still there, the house?
I believe it is.
So you remember that one?
He was 23, his wife was 20.
Oh, 23.
And to think, try to think back about these days when things were going on. In the earliest days, the first plan, the heartache with the mine has always been transport of ore and the concentrate. Getting ore out of the ground here is no harder than it is in another place. It's getting from here where they're using it. And so, in the early days, the thought was there would be a railroad, a small gauge railroad, that would start down in Lucerne, would start in Refrigerator Harbor, which is the south edge of the Lucerne Mass, come up the switchbacks, and then come up the valley. So in the earliest days, when all of this stuff was going on, it was all coming in by horseback. That's one of the earliest. I'm trying to make some joke about that. People coming to Old Village. Here's an early version of the road. This in the 19... Once Howe Sound got involved, they decided that running stuff on trucks was going to be cheaper than running the railroad, so they widened out the roadbed to widen out the railroad right away to the roadbed. This is an early camp that is in the location of Huntington Heights, which is up on the hillside. Here's Holden, probably 1917. This is Crooker Perry, who took over from Holden and then sold to Howe Sound. And this is a picture from 1938. 1937 was utter pandemonium. Howe Sound got involved in 1930 and tried to run started to try to build a mine, but shut down operations in Prairie One over another down dip in the depression. And it sat kind of idle with big plans being made until 1936 and into 37. And from 37, the year of 37 was a huge year where prior to that, not much was above ground. All the work that had been done down the line. So in order to get everything in here, there was a lot of prefabrication that was done down in Chelan, stuff being pulled up here on barges, yarded up the hill in pieces and built here. And I have 2 minutes and I'll be done. So this is the mill building here. The back part of it, you still see the skeleton of. And Copper Mountain behind us. The last piece of the puzzle was power. All along, the people who were involved had tried to work with the state of Washington to be able to build a dam down at Lucerne to generate power. That never worked out. So power to the mine when it was operating came from the south end of Lake Chelan. Power lines were run up the north side of the lake to Prince Creek. Across the lake, 4,650 long piece of wire at 130 feet above lake level, cut behind Donkey Lake and then traveled from there. First power was here in January of 38. First ore was processed in about April, was processed in March. First load went down the hill in April. Truck from right here. Barge at Lucerne, barge down lake, truck from Chelan to Chelan Falls, rail car from Chelan Falls to Tacoma without a subway smoke. If anybody is not exceptionally hungry and wants to stay and ask questions, I'll be